You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 102.7 FM.
Starts with the anti-prorogation rallies. Remember those? How quickly they developed. When Harper had a minority, he prorogued Parliament. Somebody put up somebody from Alberta put up a Facebook page, and within a week there were 60 demonstrations across the country, some of them very large. And this was the Toronto one, and the theme was democracy. Of course, I was talking to someone from Paris who said if that had happened in France, then it would have been seen as a coup d'etat and there would have been a revolution. But hey, it's Canada, so. then the Green Revolution in Tehran, led by youth, a massive mobilization of people for a democratic society. Then the Tahrir Square, which of course I don't need to repeat, we all know, a year ago in January, the massive outpouring, again led by youth, of people into Tahrir Square and the occupation of Tahrir Square, which then set the frame for a lot of what came after. This is the Indignado in Spain, which we know a lot less about, or at least we hear a lot less about in Canada than we did about Egypt. But there was, a few months after Egypt, I think it started in April in Spain, a massive mobilization, over 1 million people, protesting austerity, the austerity measures in Spain, and they occupied in Madrid, this is Madrid, and in Barcelona, for pretty well the whole till the end of the summer. And a lot of the way that they organized the occupation is where Occupy Wall Street got quite a number of their ideas of what they did. And in Catalonia, in the part of Spain where which is a nation kind of like Quebec inside of Spain, where Barcelona is, they basically set up an alternate economy. They've occupied, for example, medical clinics that have been closed, and doctors and nurses are initially volunteering their time. They've occupied old folks' homes that were being closed or cut back. So they have 80 and 90-year-old spokespeople for the movement. Like, it's just incredible. And they've set up an alternate money now called the ECO instead of the Euro. And so now they're paying people with that alternate money. So some of us know about community money that gets created. It's usually pretty small, but this is big. This is a big alternate currency. And then, of course, Occupy Wall Street. This was Occupy the Capitol. It's hard, actually, to get a shot of a big demonstration for Occupy Wall Street, because that's not what it was, and I'll come back to it. And then, of course, the Quebec March, and this is the one that I was on, March 22nd. I show you this because it wasn't covered in English Canada. I wanted to show you this one compared to all the other mobilizations, all of which, except Madrid, were covered in English Canada. This march, which was the biggest march I've ever been in, except for May Day in Cuba, okay, wasn't covered at all in English Canada. It's really shameful. And why is this happening? And I use this photograph, and I see the crowd. I know everybody knows why it's happening, knows what's wrong in the world, the multiple economic crises which have hit tremendously hard, the working class, the poor were already suffering, and now the working class is suffering terribly, terribly, all across Europe. The values of their homes have just disappeared overnight, the same in the United States. The impact is terrible. But mostly, there's no more future for young people either, right? So that this generation is the first generation that is looking at not being able to do better than their parents, so they come from the middle class and the working class. And that the other side of the crisis is a massive environmental crisis, which I know you're all very well aware of, and which we've just heard from our sister from the Musqueam, of the kinds of environmental destruction that are going on in the name of profit, in the name of economics. And in our country, the indigenous people are on the first lines of that fight to stop that in many places. And so I like this picture because it shows both the suffering, the suffering of the people and the suffering of the land. But like I say, I'm not going to focus on that too much today because we want to have discussion. I want to talk more about the movement itself. I love this picture too because, you know, we have the 1% running away with all the money. And it's really the statistics, if you haven't seen the graphics, I don't have all the graphics here. They're really stunning. I mean, basically, the amount that middle class and working class income has fallen is exactly the same amount that the incomes of the rich have risen. It's like a welfare state in reverse, a trickle up. You know, they talk about trickle down economics. Well, really, trickle down economics is trickle up economics. It's a welfare state for the rich, is what we have now. A welfare state for the rich. The entire job of government, and Harper is probably the best at this, is to create conditions so that the rich get richer and the corporations profit, and the rest of us get nothing out of it except misery and environmental destruction. And one of the things we heard when Occupy Canada happened, and this was worthy of a Monty Python skit, I have to say, those of you that saw the Minister of Finance's press conference where he said, express great sympathy with the Occupy movement of the United States, understanding how people are suffering in the United States. But he said, but Canada's different because we have a more progressive tax system, which the Tories have done their very best to change. And he said, we have regulated banks, which the Tories would have changed if they could have. So it was, that's why I say it was worthy of a Monty Python skit. However, it's also not true. It is true that we're suffering, the middle class, the working class, suffering a little less here, and that's for two reasons. One reason is that we didn't have the mortgage crisis and the drop in property values that has happened in Europe. And most working class people's wealth is in their homes, right? If we have any wealth, it's in our homes. And as any of you that own a home know, and especially here in Vancouver, but also true in Toronto, the wealth in our homes has increased dramatically in the last 20 years. But it can also drop. The bubble can burst. And that's what's happened. And so people who thought they had their retirement secure or thought they could sell their house if things went bad, they can't. Their house is worth less than when they bought it, right? Their house is worth less than the mortgage they have on their house. And this is happening not just in the United States, but it's happening all through Europe as well, especially Britain. But the second reason why it's not as bad here as yet is because we fought neoliberalism more successfully than almost anywhere else in the world. That was, we fought cutbacks, we fought privatization of healthcare, for example, which was way more privatized in Britain than here, way more privatized in other countries than here. Our labor movement is still pretty strong compared to, let's say, the United States, where it was devastated by Reagan. Our social movements remain strong much longer. So, for example, the women's movement in Canada remained strong right up until the 1990s, the late 1990s, whereas in the United States, the women's movement was severely weakened during the Reagan period in the 1970s. And so we've resisted longer, and therefore the impact of neoliberalism started later. So deindustrialization, which started in the United States in the 1970s, started here 10 years ago, 10 or 15 years ago. But in terms of what's happening now, it's worse in Canada than anywhere else. In Canada, the top 1% earn one-third of the wealth. In the United States, it's 26%. Okay? So it's worse here. We have the fastest growing gap between the rich and the rest of us in Canada than anywhere in the OECD. Deindustrialization, as I mentioned, has started 10 years ago. And it's being advanced more by the Harper government's strategy, which is to go for broke, as you know very well here, because the focus now is on the Enbridge pipeline, to go for broke in making oil money. And in fact, the Guardian last week called Canada the newest petro state. To go for oil and gas money and to let deindustrialization happen. And that's what Harper's strategy is. We now have the lowest corporate taxes in the OECD. Lower, believe it or not, than the United States. And there's been a dramatic decline in the top tax rate in income tax. Youth unemployment is now at 13.9% in Canada, which is almost twice what unemployment is for the rest of us, or at least a good 50% more. So the next time somebody tells you that Canada's not so bad. There's a truth to it. As I said, our experience isn't so bad yet for those of us that have had a decent income in the last little while. For poor people, it's pretty bad, as you know. But for those of us who had a decent income, it's not as bad, but it's going to get that way. So I want to start with, as Darren pointed out, when Occupy New York happened, Occupy Wall Street happened, I went, my friend Velcro Ripper, who I'm sure some of you know, is a filmmaker. He called me, he's living in Brooklyn now, and he said, Judy, you got to get down here, this is so your thing. And a few years ago I wrote a book called Transforming Power, in which I was pretty frustrated by the way in which the left was beating our heads up against the wall in most of what I could see in North America and Europe, and I thought the one place the left was moving forward was in Latin America. And so I started to write a book about Latin America, and then I found that actually there were some pretty interesting things happening in Europe and the United States as well. So I wrote Transforming Power, which looks at what I thought were the most interesting political developments in terms of resistance to neoliberalism and alternatives to neoliberalism around the world. And Occupy kind of took all the elements that I was talking about and put it in one place. I didn't actually imagine that it would start by occupying parks, but the other elements of Occupy were in Transforming Power, and so that's why he thought I would like it. But more importantly, what all of these movements, all of those slides I showed you, all of these mass mobilizations indicate is a massive youth uprising all around the world against reduction of democratic space, or against a lack of democracy in the case of dictatorships, and increasingly against austerity. Led by youth. Not only youth, but led by youth. So the first time I realized something interesting was happening was when Brigitte Dupap stood up in the Senate. She was a Senate page, as you will remember. And it so happened I was home that day. I'd fallen off my bike. I'm doing this a lot lately, but anyway, I don't even ride a bike anymore. But So I had fallen off my bike, so I was home, so I thought, oh, what the hell, I'll watch the throne speech. And usually it's really boring, right? Like, so boring. But anyway, and I hear Peter Mansbridge, I hear the reporter say, I think there's a protest on the Senate floor. And then she said, I think it's a page holding up a sign that says Stop Harper. And then he said, then you can see Peter Mansbridge going, really? And she says, it is a page. And you can just hear the scurrying and that, like I used to work on television, so I know I could just hear the scurrying and in the studio room to try and get the shot. So I figured, okay, I'll get my BlackBerry out. I have an iPhone now. My BlackBerry out, and I got the screenshot the second they put this shot up. And I put it up on Twitter and Facebook. And then 5 minutes later, I get an email from Brigitte Dupap. They were so well organized. I mean, she sent it out to lots of people, but she also sent it out to me. And I thought, okay, everybody else is going to report this. I knew it would be huge news because it never happened before. And Peter Mansbridge says, I think this is unprecedented. Well, Peter Mansbridge says something's unprecedented. You know it's going to be big news. So I... So I thought, yeah, they'll quote her, but they won't put it all up. So I put it up on my blog on Rabble. And for a while, not only was Brigitte trending on Twitter, but I was trending on Twitter just for having a scoop. Okay. But the thing that what was powerful about what Brigitte did was that she gave up her job to do it. So here's a young woman who had the best job a political science graduate could have. There's no better job than being a page in the Senate or the House of Commons. And she gave up her job to make a symbolic protest, which she really had no idea would get the kind of attention that it got. Now, they were saying, she'll lose her job for that. And I go, duh, like she doesn't know that, you know? Like, it took them a while to even realize that she consciously did it, knowing she would lose her job, right? Because this just never happens. Young people are so inculcated, and I know it because I teach university, with, you know, having to have good marks so you can get a good job, and competitiveness, and all that matters is your career, and all that matters is how well you do in school, and then how well you do in work. And the idea that you would give it all up to make a protest is just so far from anything that any of those people in the elite of journalism think, or most people think. And so when I saw her do that, I thought, okay, where, if this is happening with one person, then it's symbolic of more than that. And indeed it was. It wasn't too long after that we saw that. But the other thing I used Bridget for is to talk about one of the elements of this new movement. I think it's one movement in fact, from Tahrir to Occupy to the Maple Spring, this upsurge of youth. And one of its characteristics is great courage. Great courage. You know, now obviously Canadian youth aren't staring down tanks the way that Egyptian youth were, but it's a different context. But in the context of Canada, setting up tents and camping in the winter in little villages in the middle of cities, it takes courage. And certainly we see that courage in Quebec, where night after night, it's more than 100 nights, 100 days rather, because they started in the day and then they went to the night, students are marching, standing up against unbelievable police repression, which you'll see in the video I'll show you later. And that's another thing that is really pissing me off about the media, which is that the police violence in Quebec has been astonishing. They put two people in the hospital. And just days after the G20 report, which every media outlet called scathing because they kettled people and they put them in cages, no one was put in the hospital during the G20. No one was beaten enough that they were hospitalized in the G20. And there wasn't even though there was supposedly a law, it was actually a lie, there wasn't a law passed by the legislature removing people's basic rights like there was with Bill 78. And yet the English media has been 100% on the side of the Sharia government and 100% against the students who they paint as vandals, right? So standing up to that and standing up to the police repression and standing up to the attempts of the Sharia government to vilify them, to marginalize them, it's just astonishing the level of courage that we see in these movements. And also in Occupy as well, where there's been quite a bit of police violence, especially in the States. The second thing is the solidarity in Occupy. You know, in the women's movement was a very powerful movement. Very powerful movement. And in parts of the women's movement, we had solidarity. Particularly the working class parts of the women's movement. But you know, from the labor movement that we learned solidarity. And we didn't always have it in the women's movement. For example, when Ralph Klein's government went after some women in Alberta for committing fraud because they were getting UI half the time, like half of them were getting UI and half of them were getting salaries, and then they switched, which, you know, we'd been doing for years in women's shelters and women's centers. And they went after them for fraud. The rest of the women's movement backed away, didn't support them in Alberta because they were afraid, right? And so in face of these right-wing attacks, when they started, there wasn't 100% solidarity in the women's movement because it wasn't as much a central part of the women's movement. But in Occupy, there is. And there's another thing about Occupy that's amazing, and I'm sure that you all know this, and that is their integration of those people who have been discarded by society. And that I don't think any of us have done. Because they were in a place where they were equal. Everybody was getting free food. Everybody was getting free shelter. And there was no distinction between people who were homeless and people who weren't. And so the homeless person wasn't a beggar, didn't have to ask for anything. And for a lot of homeless people, the ones who were able, they became quite integrated and quite engaged in the committees and the GAs and so on. Like I spoke at an Occupy Toronto meeting at OISE. Those of you that know Toronto know OISE is kind of a place that we have left-wing meetings between 500 and 1,000 people. And as I was leaving, this woman said, oh, you were up in the panel. I was so good. I'm so excited. But she was really excited to meet me. And I saw she had her cart. And I thought, you know, I've been an activist for 40 years. I've never seen a homeless person at a political meeting. Never. Not one that I could recognize anyway. And that's with a lot of anti-poverty organizing going on. So that, now, as we also know, it created problems in Occupy, which we can talk about. But, because some people weren't capable of integrating. But the way in which Occupy did that was astonishing. And the other thing about Occupy was that it was really inclusive from the point of view of class. I met so many working class people who came down, and older people often, you know, came down to see what was happening. And then, like this one guy I talked to in Toronto who said, well, I came down to see what was happening, and then I saw they were going to tent for the winter, but they really didn't know how to set up camping for the winter. So I thought I better help them. And he started building platforms for the tents. And because of the way Occupy, the culture of Occupy, is the only way I could say it, is that it was so democratic, not only in the sense of consensus, which I'll talk about in a minute, but in the sense that everyone was equal and everyone's ability was valued. So someone like me, who usually gets put to the front or seen as a leader because I'm a good talker, was not valued more than the person who could build the platform for the tent, or the person who could cook, or the person who could organize a good cleanup. And that was amazing. I'd never seen anything like that. And it was transformative. And it felt so good. You know, it just felt so good. A lot of times people will describe to me, like you go, especially in Occupy Wall Street, but even in Occupy Toronto, you'd sort of go there. And when I first went there, it was the same thing, but other people have described the same feeling. You sort of go there, and then you just don't want to leave. You just really like it. And you're not even sure why. And I think it's this inclusiveness that they had. So even though there are issues around race and gender, which I'll come back to, around class, they were inclusive. And particularly around those people who had been most marginalized and discarded. And Michael Stone puts it, the people who have been discarded, of which there are so many, and which we get used to, even though it's a relatively new phenomenon. So what can we learn? Well, the first thing is the General Assemblies. Now, a lot of us have worked on consensus for a long time. There's pluses and minuses, and I don't want to get into that unless people want to in the discussion. And Occupy, a lot of the problem of Occupy was they started from ground zero. They didn't really have the benefit of a lot of the learnings that had gone on before. So, you know, we used consensus a lot in the women's movement, and then somebody wrote The Tyranny of Structurelessness, and, you know, we went through a lot of changes around it in the women's movement. And we understand that plain 100% consensus doesn't work very well, because you're going to have people who just don't ever agree. You know, like, nobody I know, of course, but so in Occupy New York, Occupy Wall Street, where there were a lot of experienced people, they started out with a 90% consentsus rule, which purists will say isn't consensus, but it's good enough for me, you know. But the idea of consensus being that we want to hear what everyone has to say and not just polarize out a decision. That's, to me, the most important thing about consensus, is that it's an understanding of the wisdom of the group and of wanting to get to know what everyone who has something to say in the group has to say before the group decides. The wonderful human mic, which I just loved, which is, you know what it is, you know, mic check. That was pathetic. Mic check. Good, okay. So the way you use it is that you repeat
everything that I say.
And the reason they used it
in Occupy Wall Street
was because
they couldn't use amplification.
So they'd have 1,000 or more people.
And this is the way you had to speak to them.
So the first and greatest result was
no blowhards.
But the second result was.
And
I'll do it this way. If I say, I love you.
Okay?
And the feeling of it.
Is
amazing.
It makes you feel.
Connected.
Connected.
Right? And so. It was by accident that it happened. I mean, it's been used before. I saw it used in Seattle. I understood it was used. It's been used in other places. Like I saw it used in Seattle at the prison when they arrested people during the march in Seattle. There were 800 people arrested, and they had a big demonstration in front of the prison, and they used it there. And that's the first time I saw it used, but apparently it had been used before. But at Occupy Wall Street, they used it, and they started to see the power of it. And then the other thing they did is use the twinkling, which was originally used, you know, when you do this, was originally used by deaf people who can't hear applause. But then they sort of modified it to be, this is if you really like something, and this is if you're kind of lukewarm, and this is if you don't like it at all, and then there's blocks, and there's lots of other things too. But it really does help to get a sense of the room. So we would use, you know, my experience of consensus is we would use straw votes, but in a way, this and this, it's kind of like a straw vote. So that was really good too, even though the U.S. comedy shows had really fun with that, with that one. So there's a lot to be learned about how they practice democracy, both positive and negative, in Occupy Wall Street and also in the student movements. This is what I'm going to do. We're talking from Occupy to Maple Spring. When you ask the leaders of the student movement, as the media asks, how is it that you've been able to mobilize day after day after day? How is it? You know, when Peter Mandelbrot says, you know, there's only 30% of, don't forget, there's only 30% of students out on strike, he says, dripping with contempt. Sorry, but I'm really mad at Peter again. Well, just think about it, especially you labor people, think about a wildcat strike or a voluntary strike when nobody's being paid. First of all, nobody's being paid to be on strike. And second of all, they're risking their year at school, okay? So 30% of students risk their year at school in order to go out on strike. That is huge. And my experience is 90% of students support what they're doing, but they don't want to lose. The rest of the students are afraid to lose their year. So they're still going to school, but they're out on the marches, right? And there's this tiny little group, maybe 2%. I don't think it's more than 2%, but we'll give them 10%. Who's against it? Very few students that I met were against it, or that I even saw were against it. When they tried to mobilize, they had like 200 people, which, you know, at some time, you know, we know when we get 200 people, it's not a very big group, even though we sometimes like to claim that it is. Okay. So their answer to that is, how do they mobilize day after day? How do they keep so many students out? Is general assemblies. Each of these big student groups, the one they call the radical one, that's the biggest one. And their general assemblies vote every week whether to continue the strike or not, vote every week on any new proposal from the government. And when the government proposes something that they don't have, the leadership doesn't have a mandate for, they say, particularly in class, say, we have to go back to the General Assembly or we can't decide. And this is very confusing to the government. They don't understand democracy. You know, when I was in Bolivia, the first day I went to La Paz, I was in the waiting room of the minister and I was talking to a worker that was there. And this was just after, Evo Morales was elected, 6 months after. And, he said, what are you doing in Bolivia? And I said, well, I'm interested in democracy, and I think what you're doing here is a really interesting experiment in democracy. He says, ah, yes. He says, we understand democracy very well, he said, in Bolivia. Only our government hasn't understood it very well. And he said, we're hoping this one will be different. Well, we're not yet at the stage of hoping this one will be different, but we are at the stage of realizing that our government doesn't understand democracy very well, especially at the federal level. But anyway, So that, and not only do they have the general assemblies for each of the union, but the way the strikes organize is not at a school level, not at a faculty level, at a departmental level. So I taught in gender studies. Gender study votes to go on strike at McGill. And then they meet every week, or more often if they need to. And they discuss everything. So it's like an affinity group, right? Is what we would have called in the anti-globalization movement an affinity group. Small groups that meet all the time, that know each other, that are discussing all the issues of the strike. It's amazing. And that kind of democracy, the same kind of democracy we're seeing at Occupy Wall Street, is the reason that the student strike is so solid. So we have a lot to learn. And of course, a lot of our organizations, the ones from the previous periods, whether it's labor movement or NGOs or different agencies, are not organized like that. They're organized top down. And it weakens us. It's not only that it's not as democratic in some abstract way, it weakens us from the kind of mobilization that we're being called upon to do now. To put your body on the line, you have to be engaged in deciding to put your body on the line. And we understand that in labor movement and a strike, but we don't understand that on a day-to-day level. And so I think that's a really important lesson. And the second thing is that connection that we get by having that level of democracy gives us the courage that I was talking about before. This is the Occupied, We Are the 99%. It's a Tumblr site. Just put We Are the 99% into Google and you will find this site. And this site went up before Occupy Wall Street started, and it was a very simple idea, which is you write your story on a piece of paper in your handwriting and then take a picture of yourself or have somebody take a picture of you, because as the founder of the site said, people at first didn't realize they couldn't take a picture of themselves in the mirror because it was backward writing. You know, they had a few kinks to work out. And then we will type it on the computer, and they start this Tumblr site, which one story after another, one person after another, all different ages, all different classes, all different colors. And it was phenomenal. It was a simple idea that was a brilliant piece of propaganda. Not only We Are the 99% in and of itself, that idea, that claiming majority space that Occupy did, was not only did they get people to start talking about the inequality between the rich and the rest of us, but then they got people to identify with them. We are the 99%. And so the brilliance of that and the brilliance of the red square is something we can learn, which are both of those things spread. So the red square, you know, we're doing it here. Jackie gave it out at our party yesterday. We're giving it out here. We're giving it out everywhere. All you have to do is get some red fabric and cut it up and get some safety pins, and you don't even need Melba. Do you have anybody know Melba who makes buttons here? And so this kind of way, and the red square has a meaning, the carré rouge dans le rouge, which is debt. That's the original meaning, but for some of us it has other meanings. So these ideas that are emerging and the way that they go viral and the way that one person thought, I mean, we are the 99%. One person thought of that, just put it up on the web and boom, it goes sort of like that video that I showed you. It goes viral, right? So that way of organizing, which we've been able to do with the Casserole Canada as well, which is, you know, not spending hours and hours in meetings, you know, dotting every I, changing every word, making sure everything's politically correct, but just letting it happen. Let people be creative. Let people do their thing. And if it takes off, it takes off. If it doesn't take off, it doesn't take off. And I want to tell you the story of that video, which that video took place one day after somebody posted on Facebook, the people, we should have a way to show that we don't like this law, 78, and we don't think it's fair to the students. So tomorrow night, which was a big student march, everybody go out on their porch, on their stoop, with a pot and pan and start banging the pots and pan, which comes from Latin America. It's casseroles in Latin America. It's a very well-known way for ordinary people to protest. But when they went out, they didn't just stay on their porch. They started to walk. And that's this next night. That's what happened. That people started to walk, and people I know in Montreal say, it's amazing. And on Rabble, there was a piece by Ethan Cox, who's an old young anti-globalization activist, and he's blown away by the casseroles because you meet your neighbors. It's joyous, as you could see. It's all kinds of people. It got bigger and bigger and bigger, and it went all across the province. You know, even that week, somebody tried, I was on a media panel at Q, only had Quebec people instead of the usual people, who I know you guys don't like, but she's not as bad as you think, like, as a person. The right-winger tried to say, well, it's only in Montreal. And I said, no, that's wrong, because the casseroles are all across the province, because anybody can do it. Anybody can go out and bang on a pot and pan, and it's really fun, because when's the last time you bang in a pot and pan? You're probably three, right? So it's playful, and kids love to do it, so kids are part of it. In fact, kids lead it, because they did it more recently than we did, so they're better at it. You know, so it's amazing. And, you know, it was just one guy thought of it, and he actually thought of it as a way to show support, because a lot of the people who are doing it, they don't even agree with freezing tuition fees. But they don't agree with what the how the government responded to the students. And they don't agree with lots of other things. So what was a focused demonstration against the raise of tuition fee has now become way broader. And if you ask people, where is it going? Nobody knows. In that way, it's like Occupy. It's a social, I think, you know, the leader, Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois, says it's a social revolution that we need. And it's a social revolution that's beginning to happen in Quebec, because it's against neoliberalism, it's against austerity, it's for democracy and for the voices of the people to be heard. And in Quebec, it has the particular quality of wanting to protect the values of the Quiet Revolution, which are liberal democratic and social democratic values. And it's amazing. I mean, I've never seen anything like it in my life in Canada. Never. And I don't know where it's going to go. Nobody knows where it's going to go. But I think the student movement is Occupy 2.0. You know, last October when I was here in Vancouver, people were talking about Occupy already. I mean, it was only a few weeks. They were talking about Occupy 2.0 already, or November maybe it was. No, October. And I think the student movement is Occupy 2.0, because it combines some of the strengths of the previous movements with its focus, initial focus anyway, with some of the strengths of Occupy, of its breadth, of its brilliance, of its courage. And when you're in a march, on the student march, you feel the spirit of Occupy. So I talked about network politics, which is the way of letting things... Okay, so I want to say one more thing, because here I'm on the West Coast, you know? And that is, there's some other element here that... Velcro calls it love. I have a harder time using that word, but I think it's right. I think that there's a feeling of love in these movements. And the love is a kind of recaptured sense of connection with other people who you don't know. Like, it's not, you know, the love of romantic love, although I'm sure there's lots of that happening too, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a feeling of connection to other people. And in Occupy, it's fierce, because in Occupy, you're taking care of each other. You know, you're feeding each other, you're clothing each other, you're dressing each other, everything you do is about taking care of the community, right? And you really feel that sense of love, like a village. And that's been so lost to us under neoliberalism. You know, a lot of us on the left talk about neoliberalism in a very intellectual way, and the way in which they've restructured the economy, and the way in which they've, you know, devalued public services and revalued privatization, all of those things. But there's something else that it's done, and that is isolate us all from each other. Make us all see each other as either competition or a threat. People are either competition, if they're not in your family or your friends, they're either competition at work or they're a threat, like immigrants or indigenous people, right? And they filled us with fear, you know? Like, the most obvious is in the airports, you know, when you travel in the United States, and it's never, ever green. A green, you know, it's always red or yellow or orange. There's always a threat. Of what? The threat is the long lineups and the, you know, that's a threat, you know? Where's the threat? It's just crazy, you know, one big terrorist act, which was a terrible thing, and they have used that to create a level of fear that's unbelievable. So people set up tents and everybody's welcome in the middle of New York. It's revolutionary. You know, I had an argument with a friend of mine when Occupy started, who's an economist, and he said the big problem in Europe is there's no alternative. There's no economic alternative to neoliberalism. And I said, well, not yet. And he looked at me and he said, yeah, right. They're at the stage of setting up tents in a village. And I said, exactly. That's exactly what they're doing. Because it's like they turn neoliberalism on its head and then try and figure out, okay, we want a different world, but we've got to figure out. We don't know how we're going to make a different world. We have to figure out how we're going to make a different world. And that's what's happening now. And it's in Spain they say we're going far because we're going slow because we're going far. And yes, we all have a sense of urgency. But those of us who used to think we had all the answers, I see a few of us in the room. Well, we thought we could go fast. You know, when I was young, I thought the revolution was coming 2 years max, you know? It didn't quite happen that way. And so now the process of change is as important as the product. Because to convince people that there really is a possibility of something different, they have to experience it. Because everybody's so cynical. And they've heard such bullshit all their lives. And now the generation that heard more bullshit than anybody else from the day they were born practically are the ones that are throwing it off. And I think it's fabulous. So I think I'll just end there and occupy everything. One more thing I want to say is this. The other thing about Occupy, Velcro says Occupy is a methodology, not an ideology. And I think that's right. And what's the methodology? The methodology is we don't have to wait for the government to change the world. We can start right now. And you can do that wherever you are. Like when I speak to teachers now, I say, you can be the teacher that you dreamed to be, you wanted to be. Because even if you have to fill out all kinds of reports and get your kids to do tests, there's still, especially if you're a professional, there's still space for you to be the person you want to be. When I speak to health professionals, I say the same thing. You can do the work the way you want to do it. In a way that's connected to people, in a way that's supportive to people, in a way that you're in relation with other people. And the same is true in unions. We don't have to treat each other like shit. You know, because we disagree. It's a difference of opinion. You know, it's not life or death. If we have a difference of opinion in a union, it's not life or death. You know, right now in the Assembly First Nations race, there's two fantastic women running, Pam Pommatier and Ellen Gabriel. They are both amazing, amazing women. And at first I didn't know Ellen was thinking of running, so I was supporting Pam, in different ways that I could. Because I think she's great. And then Ellen decided to run. And I thought, ooh. And then Ellen said, don't worry, you know, we'll support each other. And they've been doing it. Like Ellen today, she posted something Pam had written. And Pam is saying how great Ellen is. And they're not competing with each other. You know? It's amazing. It's just amazing. It's beautiful to see. And we can do that. We can choose to do that. Each of us individually and collectively, we can choose to behave differently in whatever way, in whatever place we are. And that will make a difference. That will give space to other people who haven't been able to be competitive, to be tough, you know, to be polarized, to participate. And it'll make a difference. So I think Occupy taught me that very much and can teach us that. So, and that's what it's about, for a collectively created future in which we all participate in creating our future.